I've spent a lot of time trying to get this. Irrefutable acceptance of my blackness. But other people challenge me. Not because of my ancestry, because I break too many rules. Black bylaws.
That's artist Carrie Hawks.
23!
You must like fried chicken and hot sauce. It's cool, guys. Yeah. Still like watermelon?
81!
Quit talking white, girl.
12!
You may not go to a ski lodge. Black people don't ski, Christy. I can't do this.
That's stupid. You're here and you're skiing, aren't you?
Yeah.
So they do. Shut up and go down the hill.
Okay.
Carrie has a new movie out. It's called Black Enough, with an asterisk.
And it's not just me looking for acceptance. My family, too.
Carrie's brother, Tim, puts his hands over his young daughter's ears as though he's about to say a bad word.
I think now maybe I feel more comfortable with white people. But, and I have guilt about that. I feel bad about it. There you go.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're talking to Carrie Hawks about what it means to be black enough. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning.
So, this idea of being on a quest for irrefutable acceptance of your blackness, what does that mean? Why do you need acceptance, irrefutable acceptance?
Well, I think growing up, particularly because of the schools I went to and listening to different music, like not listening to hip hop, listening to Jimi Hendrix or like Landslide or Fleetwood Mac or things like that, sometimes my blackness got called into question. Like I was supposed to follow a certain way to be black. Like there was one way to be black. And if you did not do that thing, then your black card got revoked. So I was constantly like trying to fit in that way, but also trying to be myself and follow things that spoke to me.
You're from Kansas City, and that's where this quest for belonging begins. You've mentioned the schools you went to. Tell me about your childhood.
I moved to Kansas City when I was about 4 years old. And then in sixth grade, I got a scholarship to go to a very privileged school, private school in Kansas City. But I was one of four black girls in my grade. So it was like a total night and day. I came from a public school where there was like two white kids. And then I went to this very small private school where there was very few black people. And so it was just kind of like a big switch for me. And then my brothers were going there as well. And then, you know, as you're going through puberty and adolescence, you're trying to figure out who you are, you're trying to find your identity. And I had these things happening, like the class differences between me and my classmates, the racial differences, and just trying to figure all that out at that crucial time in my life.
These two different school settings and your different role as being sort of surrounded by other people who may have looked like you, and then being just one of four black girls in an entire grade. Can you talk a little bit about how that felt different?
Well, I felt a little different when I was at public school, but I mean, everyone there was black, so it was never like a racial issue per se. Like, you know, sometimes like you have to wear these sneakers. These sneakers are in. If I don't have them, then oh no, I'm not in. And then when I came to the other school, it was just like sometimes you were incredibly visible but also invisible at the same time. Like people would call you by someone else's name and you're like, no, that's the other black girl. I'm Carrie, or things like that. And so you stuck out, but then at the same time you weren't a person.
You talked about in the movie Black Enough about being invited. I can't remember whether it was to homecoming or prom, but that was a kind of poignant story. Would you mind telling it?
Oh, yeah. So homecoming was coming up. That was probably like the first high school dance. That was the first high school dance that I would have gone to, I think. And there was a black guy in a lower grade than mine. And he basically kind of worked his way through most black girls at the school. And then eventually, like after like things didn't work out or people rebuffed him, then he asked me to go to homecoming. But then he got along well with his ex. So that didn't work out. So I was just kind of like, oh, well, OK. I guess I'm second to last picked, and then I don't get the corsage after all.
You mentioned in the little clip that we played, it's the opening of your movie and also it was the way we opened this show. You mentioned black bylaws that you sort of, defy. What was your earliest sense that you were defying some kind of spoken or unspoken rule about what it meant to be, quote unquote, black enough?
It's hard to pinpoint the earliest, but I do remember a lot of times people saying that I talked white. And I would be like, well, this is how my mom talks and this is how we were raised talking. So this is just how I talk. And they're like, no, you talk white. And I'm like, no, like I talk like my parents. My parents aren't white, so therefore I can't talk white. So I think that having that early conversation was like, oh, something's off here about me.
There are some details in the movie also about maybe like how you dressed or the music you listened to. You've already touched on music, but can you talk a little bit about how like personal expression of through appearance?
Yeah, so I definitely had a goth phase, which I still feel like I'm a goth inside always.
But
I wore a lot of black. I wore inside always, yeah. Well, when I first started wearing colors in college, my friends like, Carrie, you'll always be a goth. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. But I wore a lot of black. Like, I got these amazing combat boots with steel-toed shoes at the Salvation Army. I had a collar at one point with spikes on it, like black fingernail polish.
And this is the 90s, so that was kind of a look.
Yeah, it was definitely a look. Not necessarily always popular, but definitely a look.
The one sentence promotional description on the website for your movie says, a queer oddball seeks approval from black peers despite a serious lack of hip-hop credentials and a family that talks white. Can I ask you, first of all, a queer oddball, is that how you see yourself?
Yeah, especially growing up. Like, I've come to New York now and there's oddballs everywhere. So it's like, you're not always necessarily the weirdest person there. And I'm definitely not the weirdest person here. But growing up there, I just felt like there weren't a lot of people like that around. Like I'd go to a goth event, there wouldn't be a lot of black people around. I was still in the closet at that point. So I didn't know if there were queer people around. So I just felt alone a lot of the times. And this was also before the internet. So I didn't know that there were other people out there like me. I didn't know about things like Afropunk. So I just thought like, oh man, I'm just totally off here and nobody's gonna be like me ever.
How did you deal with that?
Not well. I'd say I had depression for a lot of times when I was in middle school and high school. I can be extremely shy or I can be extremely outgoing. So I just mostly went for the shyness, I think, in high school. And just kind of stuck to myself. I had some good friends and then we stuck together, but, I definitely didn't feel confident.
And what do you mean when you say you lack hip-hop credentials? Are hip-hop credentials, does that weigh heavily on you still, or is that sort of a childhood thing?
Not so much anymore. Like, I've come into my own a lot now, but I remember getting teased for not having the new Warren G album. Like, I had a single, but I wasn't listening to the entire album, whereas I was really into Marilyn Manson or Nine Inch Nails, and that did not fly with a lot of people who wanted me to be listening to one thing or the other. But when I came to New York and I went to Barnard, I went to the Barnard, like basically the black women group for students at Barnard. And I kind of admitted like, oh, I like heavy metal. And then someone else in the group was like, oh, I like country. And then it was kind of this moment where like, oh, we're allowed to like different things and we could still be black. And this is... It was like I was nervous to say it in front of a group of people, but then it was like, oh, I'm not the only one. This is fantastic.
But this is, you know, a long time past that realization that you can like whatever music you like. And it's still something that you're working through enough that you needed or wanted to make this movie. And I want to understand that, like, what is the evolution of how you address these things for yourself and just larger, just on a societal scale?
Well, I started making some artwork about racial identity when I was in college and then a little bit after. I had like a small little comic, like just a couple panels called Yellow Number 5, where I was just dealing with issues of like not listening to the right music, not dressing the right way, not speaking the right way. And a lot of that was me pushing back on those ideas that I had to be a certain identity, even though I felt very awkward about it. And then eventually I moved to Atlanta, where I was like, I'm just going to be surrounded by Black people and then it won't be an issue. And even there, I feel a little bit nervousness, like, oh, when they find out that, you know, I like Fleetwood Mac or I do this certain thing, then they're not going to like me anymore and that it's over. And that didn't always happen. And then I started exploring more things about African diaspora and parts of the culture that I really did like. And so I felt like I was finding things that responded to me versus finding things that I was supposed to respond to. So that helped a lot. But making the film was kind of just a way to accept myself and to love myself more.
In the movie, you talk a lot about your family. And in fact, you interview members of your family, your mom, your dad, and your brother. And everyone shares kind of different attitudes toward Blackness and Black identity. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, well, my mom grew up in the segregated South. So she had a lot of things that she'd gone through where, like, I was feeling like you were separated, but she was, you know, she was on a segregated bus. She was in a segregated church. And when she got to college, it was like there was still segregation happening. So it was like literal. It was definitely not in her head and it was not just a feeling. So for her, she was definitely always Black. But then when she started working for the city, like, people would also tease her, like, oh, you talk white. And my mom grew up in Pensacola, Florida. Like, she's definitely not white. But she also was, like, dealing with the issues of what this idea of there's one monolith that is Black identity. And then my father had the direct opposite experience where he was, like, the only Black family in his town. And his father actually passed for white at some times in order to buy property. And so he was giving, like, the extreme opposite where he was. Actually, he grew up in Michigan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he did move to East St. Louis when he was surrounded by all Black people. And for him, that was kind of a culture shock to be in all Black people versus being the only one in majority white people.
I want to play a clip from Black Enough. What's happening on screen at the beginning is that we're seeing cassette tapes being labeled and relabeled, and we're hearing the sound of those tapes popping in and out of a tape player. You talk first with your mom and then with your dad. Let's listen.
I didn't live up to my mother's expectations either.
I wanted to make sure that you understood what the Black culture brought into the world.
I told you that my first tape was a Beach Boys tape that my dad had given me.
Hmm.
And you said, well, your dad's different.
TV was a big thing then. All the TV shows, cowboys and westerns were big then. Indians were bad guys. And I didn't want to identify with that. And I remember one time I came home and, you know, you scratch your skin and it turns light. So I just started scratching my arms so I could turn light and be just like the others. It's like having an oddity about you. A handicap or something about you.
That story from your dad is really heartbreaking, that he would scratch his skin to try and make himself more white.
Yeah. And it's funny because a lot of these stories I didn't know until I sat down and interviewed my family and I was like, I'm going to make a film about this. And then they just started telling me things that I never knew and we had conversations that we hadn't had before, like, a lot of people assume if you're in a family, then you know all these things about this person, but honestly, you don't. So it was also very sad to hear that he had those feelings when he was a kid. And, like, I don't know, my dad, like, I pair it with a picture of my dad when he's this cute little boy and he looks really happy, but you really don't know what's going on inside until you talk to a person.
So if your journey in search of belonging, you know, begins in Kansas City, what happens in that search when you leave home and start experiencing other places? Do you feel like you've discovered different attitudes toward race, different ways of moving through the world when you go to different places? You go to New York, Japan, and Atlanta.
Yeah, it was funny in Japan because at my school in Kansas City, it was one of very few. And then in Japan, it's like, the majority of people are Japanese. So if you're white, you're a minority. And if you're Black, you're a special minority. And it was just, it was really weird to be walking down the street there because I taught English there and a lot of my students had never met a Black person in their life. So they had some ideas about what blackness was. Like, I went to hip hop and they're like, oh, obviously, like, you were the best dancer. And I'm like, I'm a good dancer, but I don't necessarily know these hip hop moves. Like, they were like, you know, spinning and break dancing, and I can't do that at all. And then in New York, there was definitely more of a many different ways to be black or to be anything. I feel like so many different kinds of people come here, and there's so many different ways of expression that you're not really as odd as you think you are. And then when I went to Atlanta, it was just like, oh, this black Mecca, like there's blackness everywhere, people doing poetry, people, you know, speaking differently, speaking bougie or whatever. And I just felt like, oh, okay, so here there's sky's the limit on what you can be.
Do you come back to Kansas City very much?
I do. I come back generally for Christmas every year. My best friend got married last summer, so I came back for that. And then here and there, usually it's once a year, sometimes twice a year.
I'm wondering if you feel like, I don't know, if you feel like your perspective on Kansas City and especially race on Kansas City has changed at all, either with becoming more and more of an outsider in this city looking in, or just having that adult vantage point, or even if it's possible that things here have changed in some way.
It's hard to say how much they've changed, because when I come back, it's just like for a very brief visit. But I do remember when I left and I went to Atlanta, and I went to this art opening, and I was like, wow, this place is so mixed, because there was black people, like, you know, five, and white people in the same room. I'm like, this is unheard of. And my friend in Atlanta was like, this is so segregated. And then I'd go back to Missouri, and sometimes the racial prejudices were just like on the surface sometimes. Like I went to some bar in Brookside, and like these patrons were giving the bouncer some, well, I don't know what I can say that, but they were giving him a hard time. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that he was black, and because they figured, well, he's black, he's not a homeowner, he doesn't, you know, earn this type of money. And he was really frustrated, and he had to work in that situation, you know, every weekend. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But, I mean, in other ways, when I go back, like, there was a queer meeting for, like, social group of people hanging out. And there's, like, more art happening. There's more theater happening. So I don't exactly know what's always happening there. But it does seem better in some ways. But then in other ways, I'm like, yeah, that's why I left.
Paul tweets us, and this is kind of an extended series of tweets, but bear with me. Paul says, I'd love to know what Carrie thinks about finding ways to make minority identities more visible in Kansas City. I don't think I was comfortable in my skin until moving to Washington to go to college. The Midwest really prides normalcy and conformity. Paul continues to say, on the coast, you have more fluid identities that coexist with corporate and professional environments. Do you think that'll change in Kansas City? Ever?
Well, I guess I'm not the only one. I think it, you know, what helps change is like seeing yourself represented like in art and music and television and things like that. Seeing your stories be told, like in theater and music, just seeing yourself presented as a whole human being, not like, oh, okay, we need a black person, let's cast this black best friend, or let's cast this other person, like a more whole identity of yourself represented.
When KCOR's Central Standard returns, what happened when Carrie put out a call for other people's stories about what it means to be black enough? Have you wrestled with that question? You can tell us your story too. What it means to be black enough at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCOR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking with Carrie Hawkes, a Kansas City native whose movie, Black Enough, is showing in New York and L.A. this June. There aren't any screenings scheduled in Kansas City, but the movie tells a story largely set here. It's about a quest for belonging and for an answer to the question of what it means to be black enough. Does that have meaning to you? Call 816-235-2888 if you have a story to share. Carrie, I'm surprised that there isn't a screening in Kansas City.
yeah, I entered a festival there. I didn't get in. And actually a couple festivals in Missouri, but I'm still waiting to hear back from St. Louis Festival. And I'd love to screen it, especially in Kansas City or anywhere in Missouri.
I'm intrigued by the call for stories you put out there to get other people's stories about what it means to be Black enough. Did you get a big response?
I got some response online. I think it's hard to like type out a whole thing and share your story online. And then I went to Afropunk, which is a big music festival here, and I went with a friend and he recorded people. I think we interviewed like 7 people, just asking them on the spot, like, what does it mean to be Black enough? And I got some answers that surprised me.
Like what?
I walked up to this woman wearing a dashiki and natural hair, and she just joked like, oh, I don't feel Black enough. And I was like, you don't? Like, well, if you don't, well, then I don't know where I am. And then another young person, they gave a really warming answer, which basically they said that to be Black enough means to mean that you have to love yourself more, because you're going to get a lot of pressures and like negativity, so you have to always love yourself more. So those were 2 surprising answers that I got.
There's a story you tell in the movie about a time when one of your friends, a Black friend actually, teases you about your feet. Let's give that a listen.
I knew it. Now I got proof.
Well, what are you talking about?
Your feet are so pale, they're paler than Jamie's. And she's a redhead.
So?
So you're not Black. You're just a white person who got a tan and forgot to take her shoes off.
Jamaica always teases me, but today I can't take it.
So who decides whether you're Black and just how Black you are, if there are degrees?
I think what I've learned is that I do. And I, you know, other people are always going to have their opinions. You cannot control what other people think, but you can control like what you do and what you do with your emotions. So for me, I've kind of like decided like I'm not going to let that part of me be beholden to someone else, whether it's my Blackness, my queerness, like anything about me. But I know that those are always going to be competing forces happening.
In the end, I don't want to spoil the movie, but there, a DNA test ends up being like mm-hmm. this ultimate place where you turn. And there's a recurring image of a Black card as in like a credit card that says the Black card. And this is what you're trying to get. And ultimately, you decide that a DNA test is probably the best way for you to get that. But why did you want to get your DNA tested? Did that feel like it would give you objective proof that you are Black? Like, is that what you were actually searching for when you did that?
When I did that, I just wanted to know more about my family history, because I think for a lot of Black people in America, and also a lot of people in America, your ancestry only goes back so far. So you don't really know where you came from or where your people came from. So I was curious, like, how could science tell me more about where I came from and more of my story? And at the time, 23andMe was letting Black people do DNA tests for free. So I was like, all right, I'm in. And then I got the results and I was really nervous. But when I got them and I was like, oh, okay, I feel better now. And actually, the same company is sponsoring a Mixed Remix film festival that I'll be in L.A., all about mixed race people, because I think for a lot of people, in America, they're like, well, you know, maybe I'm English, maybe I'm British, maybe I'm Nigerian, but this can kind of give you an idea of like where you could have come from.
The percentages. So you were, was it more than 50% African?
Yeah, and that was the part that I was like, yes. A lot of people are doing that, and you don't always get back what you think you will. And in some ways, that's good. Like, you can realize that you're part of this big world and you have a mixture of a lot of things. But also, I can't let that tell me if I'm Black enough either. Like, ultimately, it's up to me. And, like, my science is one thing, but, like, just like your genitals don't define your sexual identity. Like, that doesn't necessarily mean that, yes, you have passed this mark. Although when I got it, I was really happy. But I think even if it had been like 48%, I'd still be like, no, I'm still Black.
I mean, did you actually feel different inside when you had that information that came from taking saliva and sending it to some people and getting back, like, analytics on that?
I did. I felt happy. I felt a bit of relief. And I had to, like, preface that by not saying that I think one people is better than other people, but it just fit the me that I had, and I was happy to see that. And I was also curious because at that point I had never been to the continent of Africa, so I was curious, like, where my people would have come from, and, like, with the slave trade, like, did we come from the west parts like most people did? And I was fortunate enough to go to Tanzania last year, and I was talking with our we did Airbnb there, and I was talking to our host, and he was like, oh, well, you know, you could have come from East Africa. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. But even he, when he was saying he would go visit Sudan, and he's like, whoa, those people are black, and, you know, I'm not even that black. And I'm like, you live in Tanzania, you're from Tanzania, like, how can you not be black? Like, it was funny to hear him also talk about that.
Let's hear from Amber. Amber has called us at 816-235-2888 to tell her story about what it means to be black enough. Hi, Amber.
Hi. My name's Amber. I'm 30 years old, and I've grown up in the Kansas City area. I'm a biracial woman, so I'm half black, half white. So this is something that has constantly plagued me. Just kind of my two cents on the matter. I've grown up in predominantly white communities, and oftentimes the question of being black enough has been centered through the lens of white people. Not very often do I hear other black people tell me that I speak too white or listen to white music. It's often white people that tell me those things. So I just think that's kind of interesting. I feel like I've been readily accepted by the black community, despite my white upbringing. So I just think it's interesting who gets to determine or ask about what it means to be black.
Amber, why do you, like, can you tell me more about the tone that people are using when white people are questioning your blackness? Like, how does that come up? And I don't know, like, what's the sort of attitude that comes with that questioning?
Almost congratulatory, like, you're not like the black people I know. You're different, you know, you're into a different ideas than I'm accustomed to perceiving that black people are into. And it's like, you know, you're not one of them type of deal. So that's kind of the experience I get from it. It's a positive thing for white people that they can feel like they align with me in some way, I think.
Carrie, does that sound at all familiar to you, or did you have just a totally different experience?
Oh, no, that definitely sounds familiar. I just concentrated the film more on the conversation mostly with black people, but I definitely got that growing up, like, oh, well, you know, you're different than the other ones, or like, you're more like this. And I think they definitely found comfort in it, but it made me more uncomfortable, and I took it kind of as an insult, like, oh, if I'm not like other black people, then what in your mind are other black people like? If I'm your friend, why wouldn't you be their friend? Yeah, it made me feel uneasy.
Amber, how has that made you feel?
Uneasy as well. I've tried to impress upon white people who do make those kind of sentiments that black culture is not monolithic, that there's not one idea of what it means to be a black person, so they shouldn't assign these kind of arbitrary values. So, I mean, I also agree with her. It's not something I enjoy hearing by any means. It discredits a whole half of my being. So,
well, Amber, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Okay, thank you.
And Carrie, I want to move on to one of our other callers, but you do have this sort of intersecting search for identity that has to do, in the movie, mostly with race, but also in the way you describe the movie, a little bit with gender, too. I mean, you describe yourself as a queer oddball. Can you talk a little bit more about how these two senses of belonging and identity intersect?
If you bring up intersect, then I also think of intersectionality, Kimberly Crenshaw's term that she coined, where basically, like, you're not just a black person or a queer person or identify as genderqueer, a genderqueer person. You're all of those things at once. So I can't really take out those parts of my identity and treat them one by one. So, like, when I joined the black group at Barnard, like the head of it was a lesbian, and like she got a lot of flack from people for being a lesbian, and you know, you're a black lesbian, like this is a thing that white people do. Or as I'm meeting a few more genderqueer people, like I think that's another layer of my identity that people are dealing with at the same time that I'm also dealing with. So it's, for me, they're all together. Like I can never just be a black person and separately a queer person. I'm a black queer person. And there's identities with that. And then, you know, then there's like, oh, are you queer enough? And like, I don't know. It's, there's all these levels that you have to contend with.
Let's talk to Teresa. Teresa has a question or maybe a story for us. Hi, Teresa.
Hey, Gina. This is one of the better shows I think you've had in the last year. I'm listening to it in my car, and I'm not even going to go home until your guest is great. Thank you so much. I totally agree with what Amber's saying, and I'm empathetic to that. I'm a white woman. But I guess I wonder why, and I think this is maybe white society that makes people do this, but why do you have to say you're one or the other? Like Barack Obama, I'm going to use him as an example, or Halle Berry, one white parent, one black parent, but they both identify as black, which is their total option. But why did they have, why do they have to say that? What makes people feel like they have to say one or the other? That's really my question.
I think that's an interesting question. Also, when thinking about the history of race in America, and like racism and segregation, a lot of times there is like this one drop rule. So if you were even a part black, then you were not, you know, admitted to this part of the society. You're not allowed to sit in the front of the bus. You could be a slave. You could, like, all these things happen because you were not 100% white in someone's eyes. Or like, in my grandfather's case, when he wanted to buy some property in Michigan, like he was able to buy it as a white man, it was easier. And I don't know if he would have been able to buy it as a black man. So for him, he had to make a choice. Sometimes he was actually had the option, like he could pick one or the other depending. But for a lot of people, they don't have that option. And because of how people are classified, like, you're forced to choose. And if they see any hint that you might have African ancestry, that's it. You're just black. But I'm really excited to go to this mixed festival in LA because, as I was talking to, I think, one of your producers, like, when you're a mix of black and white, people, a lot of people just say, like, oh, well, I'm black. And they see you're part black and that's it. But say you're a mix of Japanese and Nigerian or Indian and Persian, like, those are two very strong cultures that, like, one of them doesn't necessarily cancel each other out. And I don't think my blackness also cancels out my European ancestry. But in those cases, unlike the one drop rule in America, I think people are like, oh, well, yeah, you can't just be Japanese if you're also Japanese and Persian. You're both of those things. But I think in America, we've kind of been forced into that way. And I'm also very happy to be black. So I don't know. It's I think in this country, it's very particular with that racial mixture.
Let's hear from Donna in Kansas City. Donna is of a different generation. And I'm curious, Donna, how you think your experience is similar or different from Carrie's, being of a different generation?
Some of us very similar, because I was raised in Pittsburgh, Kansas, which is very few black people live there. And I was the only black in my class until I was in the sixth grade.
How old are you, Donna? Do you mind sharing that with us?
I don't mind. I'm very proud of it. I'll be 72 years old this month. Okay. Not this month, next month, June. This is May, June.
Okay, and go on with your story.
Yep, so when I graduated from high school, I don't remember the total number of students in our class, but, you know, maybe there was 200. In that, there was five black people, and one of them was my cousin. So that was the way that I was raised, although we did not necessarily socialize with the white kids. When I got out of college and I came to Kansas City, I was telling your producers that I would pass on the telephone because I'm a very dark-skinned black person. But I could, if I was trying to get an apartment, well, they would not rent to black people. And so I would call and make an appointment on the phone. I wouldn't just, if they set a sign in the yard, you know, saying it's for rent or whatever, we wouldn't do that. I'd call on the phone because I knew that on the phone they thought I was white. And so, and then when I get there, they would be shocked. And of course, they said it was already rented and I wouldn't get it. But it became kind of a game, I guess you might say.
It sounds like, so we, I mean, you had to operate in a way where you had, I don't know, like, as far as this question about how black a person is, that the answer was different depending on whether it was based on seeing you or hearing you for other people.
For other people, but also in the workplace, I had never been around a lot of black people. And because I didn't sound like black people in Kansas City, I felt like the black people were a little leery of me because they thought maybe because I sounded so-called white. And also because I'd interacted with white people all my life. See, my cousin, who was raised in Kansas City, had gone to black schools all her life. She had a really difficult time when she came down to Pittsburgh to go to school because that was the most that she'd ever been around a lot of white people. So when I came to Kansas City, I think black people were kind of skeptical of me. And then white people just, you know, they just kind of keep their distance anyway just because you're black. So it's just kind of an odd place to be in.
Yeah, you know, Carrie, there's something that kind of keeps coming up again and again, which is that so much of this depends on exactly where you are and when, that if you go from, you know, one school to another or one town to another, everything can change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I mean, it's like people, they're not fixed. Even people at different points aren't fixed. So each place has its own culture in a way. Like there's the mass culture, then there's, you know, American culture, then Missouri culture and Kansas City culture. And it's like, oh, there's culture on 18th and Vine versus culture in Ward Parkway. Like it's just every situation is different. And it kind of, by putting yourself in a certain situation, like you become part of that culture, and how people treat you and how you react is also tainted by that culture. Tainted or, you know, benefit sometimes, but yeah.
Carrie, your movie Black Enough is screening in New York and L.A. and at big venues, too. How psyched are you right now?
I'm very excited. Yeah, it's going to be at the Brooklyn Museum on June 15th, and I'm very honored and excited to be there. They have a exhibition right now called We Wanted a Revolution. It's black queer women artists from 1965 to 1985, and they're showing my film along with a lot of other great work as part of Black Queer Brooklyn on Film. So I'm very excited that an institution is supporting this kind of work and supporting black queer artists. The Brooklyn Museum is great. It's one of my favorite places. And then also this Mixed Remix Film Festival, I'm very stoked to be there as well, and that's on June 10th.
Carrie, thanks for joining us from New York to talk about your new movie, Black Enough with an Asterisk. It's been great catching up with you.
Thank you.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, the money we exchange online is beginning to shape the physical world in strange, unexpected ways. Stay tuned for that conversation up next. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And in Kansas City, we're all kind of obsessed with how our airport might be changing. But our next guest has been studying airports for 15 years, and he's noticed something shifting that goes way beyond airports. How e-commerce is starting to change the cities and regions those airports connect. Derek Choi, with us from the architecture firm Populous America. Good morning.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am well. I am well. I was actually in Kansas City yesterday and almost forgotten that I had to be back here in Boston for a day. So greetings from Boston.
Hi. Well, you know, why were you studying the relationship between airports and e-commerce to begin with?
It's an interesting question, and it was the impetus for a comprehensive in-house research effort in our office. Which started off with a very simple set of questions by one of our airport clients who asked us three questions. One was, how do I figure out what to do with these Ubers at my airport? how do I finance a lot of these improvements at the airport? And the last question, which really piqued my interest, was how do I bring Amazon to my airport? And 2 years ago...
But wait, what does that mean, to bring Amazon to the airport?
Exactly. Well, we probed a little bit harder and internally started doing a little bit more research and understood that Amazon was in the midst of a series of pilots to bring their own cargo network into the U.S. airport system. So it was something that many airports that, as you all well know, airports service both passenger traffic as well as cargo traffic, and there was intense interest in certain regions to bring in an Amazon-like carrier to distribute goods throughout the country. So that started a thought process internally for us to understand what are the impacts that e-commerce is having to our airport systems, and what sort of changes should we be thinking about? And the fundamental question that came up from this internal research was, my goodness, could there be an e-commerce airport of the future around the corner? And that's something that we're grappling with, as with many of our clients.
So like the idea that goods might have their own separate airports?
Correct. If you think about the historic network of logistics, we've had big, large rail networks with large depots for distributing goods. We've had ports and harbors with major shipping depots. And why can't airports start to think about an entirely e-commerce-driven environment? And given the limitation of airport development area throughout the country, that's a much more difficult proposition to have an exclusively cargo and e-commerce-driven environment. But it's certainly a question that is creating a very difficult dilemma for some clients to decide whether they should be looking at the expansion of cargo or passenger terminals, which impacts, you know, all of our flying public.
Well, so help me understand a little bit better what is happening right now with the way we move freight, how we transport the goods we buy and sell, because that part of e-commerce for the consumer is really out of sight, out of mind. We don't see our goods moving around. They just appear at our door.
Correct. And they're appearing faster and faster. Notions like just in time, you know, same day delivery, and all that is changing and getting faster and faster. So going back historically, in at least in recent memory, most air cargo was processed somewhere and sent through UPS or FedEx, and sent to major sortation hubs, if you will. And these are the traditional locations where you have a large FedEx sortation facility, let's say in Memphis or Louisville, Kentucky, if you're UPS. They would all get sucked into a big sortation facility, and they would be sent out to regional locations. Typically, it hit the airport first, and then it would go into a regional hub, and then they would go into vans that would then deliver the products. Well, all of that is changing very quickly with e-commerce, where you may have heard of Amazon's fulfillment centers, you know, which are large. You can imagine them as, you know, UPS centers on steroids, where they would take all of the region's goods and process it and send it to different locations. In some cases, they would send it to a UPS processing facility, or might send it to a FedEx. And then there's also a third-party approach where it starts shooting out different goods through these Prime Now warehouses. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the concept of Prime Now. Prime Now is, again, one of those just-in-time, same-day delivery systems, which then go into third-party vans. And in some neighborhoods, you might see a lot of white vans and shuttles going around neighborhoods delivering goods on the same day. So what we're seeing is a real decentralization of the system.
Yeah, it sounds like do I understand right that it's not that it's the difference between regionally sorting things and regionally mm-hmm. having the supply of goods ready to go?
Right. It really is a combination of both. The regional sortation has gotten faster and more decentralized. And with these technologies of getting further and further out in much faster speeds, the ability to reach out to sources of goods, products, has also been expedited. So another point I do need to make is that the e-commerce players, again, like Amazon, are looking to create their own independent airline, basically. So they're replicating the capacity of FedEx or UPS, and Amazon itself has struck an agreement with a third-party service provider to operate 20 Boeing 767s out of Wilmington, Ohio. So we are seeing sort of a parallel universe of this so-called, you know, e-commerce airport that I was talking about earlier in our conversation.
And this has all already been kind of shifting under our noses, which is kind of an amazing thing. But also, I mean, it sounds like, okay, a business like Amazon can be not only our bookstore, but also our movie theater and also our UPS and our FedEx. And also, it sounds like our airlines.
Absolutely. I guess in the retail world, they call it a omni-channel strategy to engage the customer in so many ways. One, from a bricks and mortar approach, which you're seeing in the resurgence of these bricks and mortar bookstores that someone like Amazon is operating. At the same time, they are
I should acknowledge that we're talking to you remotely and that there are some sirens in your background.
Yeah.
Boston sounds very dangerous.
maybe too many Amazon Prime trucks colliding.
Okay, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to help our listeners understand that. Go ahead.
Yes. So what we're seeing is an intensification of these e-commerce players being a part of everything. In some ways, you know, now that you see UPS working on Sundays, you know, you see a co-opting of some existing systems that the e-commerce players are really taking advantage of. We're seeing a third of the products being delivered by the USPS on behalf of Amazon. And I think that sort of insertion into your everyday life, you know, from USPS to your airports to being in your bricks and mortar environment and being obviously in the ubiquitous smartphone, has really changed the way we connect with products. It's not just, you know, clicking something, but it's that sort of omnipresent element that e-commerce plays today. And it's very powerful, and it's physically shifting the way we plan and think about our infrastructure and our facilities. And I think most positively, a reuse of a lot of systems.
Well, can I jump in and say, I mean, in Kansas mm-hmm. City, when you talk about infrastructure, we are having a huge community-wide conversation right now about the future of our airport. And do you think the choices we're making about whether and how to renovate our airport could make a difference in the role Kansas City ultimately plays in all of this, or are larger forces than that at work here?
Yeah, I think to be globally competitive, it is absolutely critical to have facilities that are consistent with international and national standards. And obviously, this is a building that needs to adapt and change for the future. And I think e-commerce is a big part of it. It may not influence necessarily the terminal itself, but I think the regional systems, you know, will benefit from the confluence of e-commerce.
Well, our time is up. Derek Choi, with us from Populous America, thanks for talking to us about how e-commerce is changing airports and, in fact, the larger physical landscape. This is interesting.
All right. Thank you.
You can listen back to this discussion or anything else you've heard on our show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org MidwesternIsH.com/Central Standard. And if you still want more, check out our new podcast, Midwesternish, with stories about what life is really like in the Midwest. Our upcoming episode is all about Confederate monuments in Missouri. Tomorrow on Central Standard, how did high school yearbooks deal with politics this year after a polarizing election season? We'll find out tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.